Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Today's conversation is a bit different because we're not just talking about creativity as a concept. We're talking about creativity as something you can lose, but also that you can get back. Dr. Andre Walton is here. He's a best-selling author, a TEDx speaker, psychologist, and the creator of Banish Burnout. But what makes this conversation so powerful is his journey. This is someone who in his 20s turned patented inventions into global market leaders, whose technology was used by legends like Frank Sinatra, and whose work became a global standard in medical innovation. And after building, selling, and scaling at the highest level, he went on to study the psychology of creativity itself. And so today we're not just diving into theory, we're talking lived experiences, neuroscience, and real world innovation. It's so good to have you here, Dr. Andre. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much. And it's great to meet you, Lisa.
It was so good to meet you. You know, you've operated at the highest levels of innovation. Have you personally experienced moments where your creativity just disappeared?
Yes, I have actually. When I turned my inventions into marketable products and then built them up, in the course of growing that business, and we were growing it to we had offices in, here in the States and also in Europe and a lot of dealerships around the world and so forth. So in the course of creating that structure, I did suddenly step back one day and say, where's the innovation gone in my life? Because even after the process of inventing these products, there was still a lot of invention, a lot of creativity in the marketing. You know, a lot of these those products actually got to where they were global leaders in their field through guerrilla marketing. I didn't have, you know, $1 million to chuck at the whole marketing process. You know, there was a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity going into the marketing process. But there comes a point where, you know, the structure can actually get in the way of that innovation. So, right. Yes, the answer is I did notice that. Actually, the other time when I noticed that was towards the end of my entrepreneurial career, well, just before I sold the businesses, and I was struck down by burnout. And okay. That really eradicated a lot of innovation until I could overcome the burnout. So yes, I'm familiar with that phenomenon.
I was just going to ask you that. I feel like so many high achievers often hit points where they feel so mentally stuck, even though everything looks good on the outside and they look really successful. So why do you think that is?
I believe that's an imbalance in the way that we see the world. One of the things people don't always realize is that there is a sort of known psychological process whereby stress can get in the way of good decision making. So what stress tends to do is something called seizing and freezing. So if we're making a decision, normally when we're not stressed and so forth, we can have a look at the options and then choose the best option that we believe for the solution. And when we're under stress, we tend not to do that. We do something called seizing and freezing. And we seize the first option we see and we freeze the looking for any further options. So basically, instead of having an array of, think of it like brainstorming. You know, if you brainstorm with a group or on your own, you know, you plaster the wall with post-it notes with little messages on them and ideas. Well, you're not doing that under stress. You've got one option, the first one you think of, and basically you focus in on that. So this is a very divergent thinking process. It's convergent thinking process. You're funneling in, and this is a function of stress. So I think people tend to get stuck because they no longer see the options in their life. They no longer see the future. They're like a racehorse with blinders on. And the way of getting around that is to reintroduce creative thinking processes, because that's a very divergent process. That's the process we had when we were 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. And we couldn't think like adults. We couldn't think in that way where adults, if we need to make a decision, however trivial it is, what breakfast cereal am I buying here in the supermarket, or are we going to move house? It can be any kind of decision. As adults, we go into our memory and we think, have I ever been in this situation before? And clearly, in terms of the grocery store, many, many times. So, if you have, then you use that previous experience as a template. And so, you then basically use that as the basis for how you're going to act now in this new situation. And that's not possible as a kid because you don't have the history. You don't have that file cabinet full of templates of previous experience. So, that's the epitome of creative thinking. It's like, a kid sort of putting a new piece into a jigsaw puzzle. They have to look where it fits. And that means they have to look at the big picture. And creative thinking is known in social sciences to be a very divergent way of thinking, a very big picture way of thinking. And I think you can probably see that if you take somebody that's got the racehorse thing going on here, and you start to introduce creativity back into their lives, then it's almost like sort of putting a convergent lens next to a magnifying lens. You end up with you balance the view, so you start to bring back that ability to see the options in the future, to see, not just the light at the end of the tunnel, but actually help them get out of the tunnel. So it's a very powerful process. And so I think when people get stuck, it really suggests to me most of the time that they have lost that ability to really see a world view that includes all the options they have in the future.
Yeah, I mean it's understandable with the way the world is right now. There's so much stress and sometimes you don't even realize that your body is in a state of low-level stress and if it's constant, then you're literally just doing what it takes to survive. I could see a lot of positives with having a filing cabinet full of templates, but also some negatives. Do you want to talk to us about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean it's essential in this incredibly complicated world that we've developed. I mean, our brains have not changed significantly in 50,000 years, as far as we can tell. Probably a lot more than that. And yet, I mean, even when my dad was alive, and he was born in 1896, I mean, they had. They didn't have radio or TV, and it was in the First World War where he would have seen his first airplane. So, you imagine that compared to what we have now, when we're juggling with AI, we're still, trying to master social media and the internet, and Alexa can unlock our front door and switch our sprinklers on. And I mean, it's just we have created an incredibly useful monster. And there's no way our brains can catch up with that. So we have to use these processes. If we didn't use the sort of template finding process, if we had to look at every situation as if it were new, believe it or not, we would be using as much energy as going for a walk. And so you can imagine somebody spending their morning, looking at various decision-making processes. I mean, this will be a typical morning for people. Entrepreneurs, business leaders, managers, and so forth. However small or big the decisions, if we don't use those template processes, then we're really we're putting a lot of energy on the line and speed too. The template process is incredibly quick. But the danger, of course, is that the template process encourages a kind of a knee-jerk reaction. And you can see this on a sort of really big scale if you wind the clock back to the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And immediately after that, most of the airlines really reacted in an incredibly knee-jerk way. I mean, they used that catastrophe to renegotiate contracts with the unions. They sloughed off routes, airline routes that were less profitable. They let people go where they could, and you know it's and there's one exception to that, which is Southwest. Southwest did a totally different kind of approach. They managed to get themselves to step back and say, are we actually trying to convince ourselves that people aren't going to fly anymore? No, I don't think so. So they used that opportunity to pick up some of the routes that other airlines had sloughed off, and indeed some of the staff. And then within 10 days, they had an employee profit sharing program in place to keep there, and they didn't cancel any routes, they didn't cancel any flights, they didn't let anybody go. So you can see there the difference between a real kind of knee-jerk panic reaction and one that is let's have a step back and have a look at this. And that's a very divergent kind of process as opposed to the convergent knee-jerk thing. So you can see, I think, you know, a very stark contrast there between the two ways of approaching a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that you said that making decisions is like going for a walk. Like I can so relate to that because when someone asks me something like, what do you want for dinner? There's so much power when I say, you choose, you decide. I don't want to make any more decisions. Like that's when I know I'm hitting that point of no return. It's like I don't care. Just make the decision for me. Absolutely. So you've worked with so many entrepreneurs and leaders whose businesses have stalled. So what patterns did you start to notice?
It's not uncommon to see talking about sort of a startup early years kind of situation, and I've worked with a lot of small businesses in an incubator environment, and you can see right at the beginning their business almost by definition had to have some kind of unique attribute, a unique product, a unique process, something unique about it to get the funding and the approval to be as part of this innovative kind of think tank process. And then maybe 2, maybe 3, maybe 4 years later, they have basically plateaued in terms of innovation. And when you kind of dig in there and see what's changed, and I was lucky because this incubator was in the UK, and it was basically in the south of Wales after the UK had shut down a lot of coal mines. And basically, I mean, thousands and thousands of people in the south of Wales had no work at that point. So they plunged a lot of money into these kind of incubator environments. And so I was lucky enough to be able to study them at the very beginning when they started, from the process of you know getting the funding they needed to setting it up and then getting their products out. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, as the visiting professor of creativity and entrepreneurship in the South of Wales, in Newport Business School, I was able to then go back and have a look at the changes. And one of the things that had happened in the course of growing, they're growing from a small innovative team to what you might call a sort of real company. So some of them had gone up to the point of having 50 plus people at that point. And there had to be structure put in place. And we're talking before the days when, you know, Google had a slide going down in their atrium from the second floor to the ground floor in case you didn't want to use the stairs, and then a room over here full of music instruments in case you needed a break from your work. And this kind of innovative environment didn't exist at that time. So the structure they put in tended to be very kind of traditional post-Second World War MBA kind of deal where people basically got in at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning and left at 4 or 5 in the afternoon and so on and so forth. And so that structure had really sucked all the innovative energy out of people. We all need structure. I mean, everybody needs structure. It's really one take all the structure away from people, and that's really the key to their going unhinged. So we do need a structure, but in the case of a business, there's all sorts of negative functions that can go on. One of them is quite simply that with that much structure, the world gets boring. And we just innovative or people who were once innovative do not do well with boredom. I mean, and you were seeing a lot of people leaving these businesses, basically say, well, I've done the innovative bit, so I'm going to go off and find something else to innovate. And so, but there are lots of other aspects of innovation that can be impacted very detrimentally by this kind of structure. And working here in Reno, Nevada, I worked with a very substantial publicly quoted company here that was in an industry that needed a lot of innovation. I mean, it needed creative thinking, but it was in an industry that's traditionally very very structured, very conservative, small c conservative kind of thinking. And it was very difficult. They tried to get people on board. They got one very expensive person on board who'd been very creative in a previous business, and they basically, put him in a padded room, in the back there where nobody could really interfere with him, and he couldn't interfere with anybody else. And from an innovative process, it was a disaster because the company hadn't taken on the value of innovation and creativity as a core value in the business. So, this guy complained to me. He said, I have to go to board meetings every now and again and present what I'm doing and all that kind of thing. And he said, within 2 minutes, if there are seven people around the table, three, four, maybe even five of them look as if they're just about to fall asleep. They have no interest in what I'm saying. They don't value what I'm saying. As far as they're concerned, I was just wheeled in as a kind of bright flower in the garden for all the shareholders to say, oh, yes, okay, they've checked that box. They're definitely trying to be me too. And they didn't believe it. They didn't really take it on board as a core value. So, it's creativity is a sensitive flower in the sense that, it's very easily crushed. And we find this in our own lives, don't we? Maybe there's something that we want to do that's a bit creative. Perhaps I've said to myself, I really want to play the piano a bit more. And I find myself getting buried by the fact, oh, it's tax time. So, I've got to kind of get my head down and get the figures done. It's bottom, it's very easy just to put all that stuff at the bottom of the pile. But you're depriving yourself of that core value. So try to help people be more creative and innovative is a very interesting thing, but it comes with a number of challenges. There is
Absolutely.
another very important factor too that comes into this, and that is that we have a core human drive that you're very familiar with, which is that we need to be with other people. We need personal connections, and you deprive somebody of that by solitary confinement, for instance, and it can be very, very damaging and negative. But we also have another core human drive, which is we need to be seen to be independent, unique. And that uniqueness is something that we also need to display. And creativity fits within the tension between those drives, because if we're being creative and therefore innovative, by the way, then we have to think that we have to have our unique person hat on. We have to be the unique part of that tension. And so, you know, if you think about something like brainstorming, in its traditional format, you get a group of people, sit around a table, here's the challenge, let's come up with the ideas. Well, it's not surprising that brainstorming, I mean, this has been proved over and over again, you know, all over the world, brainstorming does not do what it was originally intended to do. In other words, you've got sort of half a dozen people around the table, you actually get more unique ideas by sending them off on their own to go and write down as many solutions as they can to a problem than you do when they're sitting around the table. And when you think about it, you're creating a group to generate unique ideas. So you're actually doing quite the wrong thing, because when you're with a group, you're focused on your similarity to others.
Right.
You're focused, if you think about it, I mean, if you were to take your Harley out of the garage and go down to the Harley meet at the weekend, you'd be wearing your leathers and your, you know, I mean, you would be focused on the similarity with everybody else in that group.
Right.
And when you're being creative, or when you're being, you know, creative or innovative, you're thinking about your difference from others subconsciously, because you can't create something that's identical to the rest of the group. It's no longer unique. It's no longer an innovative product. So you have to focus on your uniqueness. And this is why typically, you know, artists or writers or whatever, they'll disappear off on their own to do their creating. You know,
yeah.
My sister's 92 years old, and when she paints, which she's in England, so she paints mostly in the summer, because it doesn't get much of a day in the winter. And she'll pile up everything in the car and off she'll go for weeks to God knows anywhere. And she'll come back, you know, with a car full of canvases painted. And so, you know, that's pretty typical of people who have creativity as a core value. But so in a business setting, for instance, when people really got very excited about team building, which is, you know, several decades ago now, but it's still a very positive kind of thing in people's minds, it's not surprising that team building is actually not very good for generating innovation.
Right.
Because once again, you're trying to connect people to the maximum possible way of doing things. And that means that people's relationship with others is the key thing in their mind when they're in that group, as opposed to being unique. That uniqueness is what you need. That sense of being different from others is what you need to be creative and innovative. So, you know, sometimes when you're working with a business, it can be very difficult to get that message across and also to find a way of implementing it within a business. But those are the essential features, really, in a group setting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it makes a lot of sense about the ability to be more creative when you're on your own. Now that I think of it, I'm thinking of so many famous authors who have gone to a private island to write their most popular book. You know, you always hear that all the time. They're secluding themselves so that they can really dig into the heart of it, which does make a lot of sense, because when you're in a group, you want to relate to each other and you don't quite the diversity that you would if it was just on your own. So what about emotional resilience? What role does emotional resilience play in innovation?
Well, emotional resilience comes as a natural consequence from having creative thinking in your cognitive toolkit. Because what has been found is that neurological imaging studies have shown that creative thinking, when you're thinking about something innovative or creative, or, you know, in your mind, perhaps you're thinking about, you know, a picture you need to paint or a piece of writing you need to do or something like that. Those you can see with functional MRI imaging the neural pathways involved in that process as that person in real time is thinking about something creative. And those neural pathways happen to be the same as when they're thinking about something with emotional intelligence.
Okay.
You could give that person something and say, okay, first I'm going to give you this, and now I'm going to ask you to think about this. And when you ask them to think about the emotional intelligence, you see the same neural pathways light up. Now, neural pathways related to both of these things. If you look at the emotional intelligence side of it, you're talking about the ability to, firstly, emotional intelligence improves your ability to have a relationship with other people. And that is a part of resilience. If you have a look at people with burnout, one of the things they almost inevitably do is push away those people close to them.
Yeah.
Spouse, family, co-workers. And that, of course, adds to their problems. I mean, these people are the ones that could actually help them,
right,
but they get pushed away. So, you know, that attachment, that ability to maximize the value of your relationship that comes with emotional intelligence is also gives you some resilience, because this is a time when, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved. So that emotional bonding with other people is inherently resilient. But there are many other aspects of emotional intelligence that also increase resilience. But the beauty of creative thinking is that ability to step back and see the big picture. And just that on its own creates resilience. You know, people that are very stressed, in anxiety, in burnout, they will get so focused on their problem. They get into what I call the hamster wheel effect, and they're basically, you know, they're trapped in these thinking patterns that relate to their pain, their stress, their anguish, and they can't see the future. It's not that they can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. They can't even find the tunnel. I mean, they are just focused on these very negative factors. And so if somebody that's able to incorporate creative thinking in their processes is much more likely to be able to stand back and say, okay, you know what? This is not quite such a big deal. I mean, let's just take this one problem at a time, and, you know, inside every big problem, there's lots of little problems trying to get out. So let's try and solve those problems, and let's have a look at the future. And there's plenty of positive options, you know. So that's so different to the kind of stress, anxiety, and burnout kind of thing, which can very sadly lead to suicide, because you know, when you can't see any positive options in your future, then, you know, life doesn't always look like it's worth living. So, you know, resilience comes from that balance that we need to have, that logical, deductive process that is inherently convergent. There are times when we need to drill down and focus in and analyze things. But if we do it all the time, we miss the opportunity of seeing the bigger picture of our lives.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk about the science behind this. You talk about in your work, your banished burnout work focuses on rewiring neural pathways. So what does that mean in simple terms? And can creativity truly be restored when someone feels like they've lost it?
Well, the new neural pathways thing is a part of reintroducing creative thinking into people's lives.
Okay.
And so, you know, by doing that, if you take our subject, our victim in the functional MRI chamber, and you ask them to think about something creative, you'll see those neural pathways. Now, if you go and ask them to think about something that's deductive and analytical, you know, you ask them to try and work out what their tax refund might be this year in their heads, you'll see a whole different set of neural pathways. So reintroducing creativity is inherently creating new neural pathways. And it's very important, because Sometimes in therapy and in coaching, it's tempting to sort of try and shift people's way of thinking in a subtle kind of way. And that's almost inevitably not very successful. If you think about this sounds a rather a negative aspect, but it's an example. If you think about sort of taking somebody that has a problem with alcohol or drugs or gambling, and you want to basically take them into rehab, the best way of doing that is to take them into a totally different environment. Maybe the rehab center in the middle of the desert, or something where they're not going to get triggered into their previous thinking. And although rehab experts tend not to kind of discuss it in these terms, what you're doing re really is to say, okay, we're going to create new neural pathways. We are going to, this is a total break from the way you used to think. So, every aspect of your life we want to change so that your brain doesn't keep slipping back to those old filing cabinet ways of doing things, right? This is that knee-jerk stuff. Oh, I'm feeling very stressed. And your hand goes for the whiskey bottle or whatever your particular thing might be. So, this is the new neural pathways thing is really the only way of saying I'm going to make a change here. And its power comes from so then the challenge just becomes, okay, what I need to do now is to find a way when I start slipping into the old habit, I need some trick to get me back to the new habit. And I mean sometimes you can even use established sort of psychological techniques like having a rubber band around your wrist and you slap it when you kind of see yourself drifting back to an old habit. But basically, the new neural pathways we're talking about are so positive. I mean, it feels so good if you are tired and burnt out and stressed to do some of these things that will get you into the new habit, which might be just going for a walk. And going for a walk in somewhere really rather beautiful. I mean, nature is a very good kind of environment to do that in. So these things can be very easily become a sort of breath of fresh air kind of this is a nice thing to do. So it's not really too much of a struggle generally to get people to switch back to those kind of processes. Now, this is all true of being innovative. As well as, the processes for burnout. So, if people are, if you're trying to create an environment where people are going to be more innovative, then they have to be given the options to do the kinds of things I'm talking about. I mean, taking taking a break and go for a walk. We all know, I think, that that can be a very good way of solving a problem. I mean, people quite often have aha moments when they're going for a walk. And there's another factor that comes in there, which is a physical factor. And that is that our brains, as are in two halves. And the two halves are joined by something that is an incredibly poor data transfer. It's called the corpus callosum. And one of the things that happens when we do a physical activity that doesn't require any thinking is that that corpus callosum actually passes more data. Suddenly, the bit rate goes up. We're not talking about a piece of string with a tin can at either end. We're now talking about broadband. And so when that happens, our creativity also goes up, and we can start to make connections between different ideas that we wouldn't normally have done. So there are actually physical responses here that are very different, as well as the physical responses of creating new neural pathways. So there are many positive things that come from that kind of process of going for a walk somewhere pretty.
I mean, is that essentially why I get most of my creative ideas when I lay down to go to bed at night? Because I feel like I lay down, there's no stress, I don't have to do anything, and suddenly I'm having all these brilliant ideas, and then I wake up in the morning and it's gone because I have to do whatever. I'm into the workday, and I always find I've got the most creative brain when I'm trying to go to bed.
Oh, that's interesting. For me, it's when I'm meditating. If I've
Oh,
got a
totally.
challenge that I'm kind of working on, then I think about it, and then it might even be a week down the road, but at some point when I'm meditating, the answer will come. And I think it's the process that, I mean, I'm not doing any physical activity at that time, but what I am doing is, I have a mantra. So I think that's taking the part of, your feet going backwards and forwards, having a walk. There's a sort of a repetitive process that doesn't happen to be related to, your physical movement. But as you say, whether that relates to that or not, I don't know for sure. But as you say, though, we don't, in this kind of crazy high-techy world that we live in, we don't often give ourselves much time to just sit down and relax and allow the space for our brain to really do what it needs to do to recover from the days and so on and so forth. And I think, that is another aspect of creative thinking, because if we're, when one of the things people don't always realize is that, when we go to sleep, people sort of think it's a function of just, just sort of relaxing and basically, calming down. And in the brain, that's not all the case. That's when our brain goes crazy with saying, let's kick out those ideas, because actually, that's irrelevant rubbish. We don't really care that, he spilt coffee over his shirt and had to change his shirt and change his, that's not an important thing to remember. On the other hand, these bits and pieces are rather important to remember, so we're going to put those over here. So, that kind of thing is what's going on when we sleep. So even then, even when we sleep, we're not really giving ourselves a chance to solve problems and that kind of thing. So, if we can just sit and give ourselves some quiet time and literally just be able to, say in my case, meditate, or for some people it's prayer, or just allow ourselves that time for the brain to, just kind of take the heat off for a moment and, freewheel a little bit, then quite amazing things can happen.
Yeah, for sure. So, Dr. Andre, how long does it take for the brain to start rewiring? If someone is out there and they're in survival mode and they want to get back in creative mode, how long does something like that typically take?
Well, you can start it immediately. I mean, it's just there is a myth that habits take sort of 3 weeks to
21
solidify
days.
in your
Yeah,
mind.
for sure. You want to quit smoking, you need 21 days. That's what everybody
Exactly.
says.
Exactly. And that it's a myth, because that's by no means always the case. I mean, some things you could create a habit in a week. Sometimes, three months later, you still are not in the habit. So that kind of way of thinking isn't really helpful, because it's not really correct. It doesn't have any real useful basis. But you can start. I mean, if somebody were in that kind of almost traumatized kind of anxiety stressed state, they can basically go out of the front door and go for a walk right now, and they can do that again tomorrow and the day after and so forth. And that process will be a very useful step in the right direction. Now, there's a whole lot of other things to do, and somebody that's working with me will actually do a custom program. And the custom program really relates to what I call the three R's. So we look at recreation and bringing back recreation into somebody's life, because it's nearly always that's one of the things that gets pushed to one side when stress, anxiety, and burnout start to happen. Relationships, we've already talked a little bit about that, pushing away those people close to us, and responsibilities. And it's not always the case for everybody, but a lot of people start to, they sort of have some underlying feeling that they need to be doing more work to solve this problem. And
More
so,
everything, all the time,
absolutely.
right?
Absolutely. And you see this a lot, being a problem a lot with women. Women are actually more likely to be to get burnout than men, statistically. And really, when you have a look at, if you take sort of professional women and professional men, the women, professional women are more likely to be the ones that have to kind of pick up the pieces domestically if there's a problem. They're the ones that get the call from the dean's office saying, oh, your son's in here again, and blah blah blah. Or the neighbor says, oh, there's a lot of water sort of pouring out of your back door. This, I mean, that tends to be, the women that have to pick up the pieces more often than the men. And so, that's the other side of this, is that if you get stress from many different directions, okay, stress at work, and then you also get stress at home, or stress because your parents are having problems that perhaps they're getting old, and maybe dementia's creeping in or whatever. And so, if you get stress from these different directions, it often adds up to being more of a problem than just stress in one direction. From one direction. There's just that, the brain having to deal with several different dimensions can be a problem. So there's lots of different dimensions to this, but those three R's are the things that I look at most carefully. And recreation is just a question of trying to find a way of making time. Get back to, if you used to play tennis on Saturday mornings, then just make sure you get back to that, or going for a walk every day or whatever. And the other thing is really just trying to be able to create the new neural pathway that when you're making a decision, just stop yourself and try and think of three other solutions that didn't come to you to that challenge. So your instinctive reaction is, I'm going to do this. Okay, well, stop and think, what, just force yourself to think of three other ways you could have solved that problem. And just that process is beginning to start the brain thinking about the process of thinking divergently. So, this can be a very quick process. It can be a process that goes on for a couple of months rather than a few weeks. But in general, you see a lot of progress in the first 3 or 4 weeks. And so, it's not something where you really have to kind of work hard at something for 3 weeks. All this stuff was also increasing fun. And it is well established in social science that if you're doing something that involves creativity or creative thinking, that actually correlates with increased happiness. So you put those together, it's a triple whammy. I mean, you've got emotional intelligence coming in there, you've got happiness coming in there, and then you've got the solution related to, your relationships and that kind of stuff. So it's a really powerful process.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I ask you to tell everyone more about the work that you do, the last question I want to ask is, how do you balance the high level work without burning out again? What do you need to understand in order to do that?
That's a great question. And the last section of my Banish Burnout programs are specifically focused on that. And basically, what you're doing is the resilience that you are generating without knowing it in the first couple of months of the program, you really focus on that. And you use that to detect, to as a tool for if you detect yourself going back to the old habits. So If we one of the things we do during that last section, actually throughout the whole program, but it comes together in the last month of the program, is we have a look at really what happened to that client when they started to get burnout. What were the symptoms? You take them right back to before they really even admitted themselves they had burnout, and have a look at what was beginning to fall apart. And okay, at what point did you stop doing your recreation? I mean, when did you stop playing tennis? When did you find yourself going to the kids' soccer games at the weekend? And so we have a look at how life started to change, and we make very careful note of what went on, because those are the kinds of ways that burnout will creep into that same person. So, and then we say, okay, so when we stop this happening, and some people are even able to journal that. And so we keep in touch, and they'll journal it, and then maybe we'll have a call every month or something like that. And I say, okay, so, are you how many soccer games did you go to? Well, I just couldn't do them all. I just, well, actually, I only went to one soccer game one weekend. Okay, so that's an alarm signal goes off then. And then, another red flag might be that, well, that, you were getting some pretty good sleep there after we did all this. You were getting 8 to 9 hours a night. So, yeah, I've just got so busy. I'm getting more like sort of 5 hours sleep now. Bam, that's another red flag. So, there are various ways that we can. And then once you've got the red flags, then you go back and you say, okay, let's have a look at our resilience plan here. Let's have a look at what we're going to do to really prevent this from getting in place. And it's a great question you ask, because people that have burnout, and that's a scary number. I mean, that's over half of the professional workforce have had burnout in the past 2 years. And 50% of those are likely to have it recur. So it's a great question, and I think you can see there, the power of being able to detect what's happening, because we don't necessarily see it ourselves. We can slip into these habits, it's without really recognizing it, and so that's one of the nice things of about if you can get somebody to actually do a little bit of a journal, and it doesn't have to even be a formal journal. I mean, I give people a table to fill in, and they can actually fill in how many sort of hours they spent on family time, how many hours they spent recreationally, and so on and so forth. It goes on, and then if you start to see those numbers sort of drift in the wrong direction, then that's we've got a resilience plan already in place.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's powerful work. We did talk about how the unlearning. I find it so fascinating about attachments and detaching from results and taking our power back. And I mean, we could talk about that on a future episode, but those are all such important pieces. This conversation has been absolutely amazing. I love chatting with you today. Tell everyone more about what you do and where they can find you.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, basically, I'm a writer and a coach, a certified accredited executive and life coach. And people can find me on my website, which is planforchange.org. That's PLAN, the number 4, change.org. And on that site, you'll find quite a lot of information about my burnout programs and the rest of the work that I do with executives and so on and so forth, and some of the people I've worked with from the Virgin Group and NASA and the Welsh Government and so forth. There's all a lot of information about that in there, and then they can book a call with me. There's a button to get to my calendar link and get a free comp, a free session with me to assess what their situation is, and whether or not it's appropriate for us to work together, or just to talk to me about their experiences. I just love to talk to people about creative thinking. And I'm always fascinated by people's burnout stories because they add to my experience process.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Lisa.
So much fun. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in. This conversation is such a powerful reminder that creativity isn't something you lose forever. It's something that just gets buried because our world can be so intense and so stressful sometimes. So when you understand how to work with your brain instead of against it, you don't just get your ideas back, but you get your clarity, your energy, and your unique edge back as well. So if you want to learn more about Dr. Andre Walton and his work, we will have his information linked in the show notes for you. And if this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who feels stuck right now, because sometimes one shift is all it takes to unlock everything again. And so many of us deserve, all of us deserve to live a fun, exciting life. Stay tuned for the next episode. Bye, everyone.